Danilana Kitchen talks about food. Danilana Kitchen talks recipes. Danilana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Danilana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prishkintas.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. And we get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Danilana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. For more information, go to themuckyduckpub.com or just call the pub, drop by, and ask for Marcus.
Today on our show, we will hear a lecture given at Iowa State University on the 10th of April by Montana wheat farmer Bob Quinn. He talks about his adventures in large-scale organic farming. You'll be hearing the voices of Bob Quinn and Liz Carlisle.
This is a book they wrote together. Liz Carlisle is, she has another book also called The Lintel Underground, and she is a lecturer at Stanford University. Specifically, I think, in environmental communications. So Bob and Liz came through on a book tour with their book called Grain by Grain. Both books that Liz has written, The Lintel Underground and Grain by Grain, are examples of farmers in her home state of Montana who, rather than being at the – so Montana is a wheat state, the way Iowa is a corn and soybean state. And these are stories about farmers who, rather than being constantly at the mercy of commodity crops, which we know right now are really not good, it is a really brutal situation for conventional corn and soybean farmers. And Bob Quinn started growing a different kind of wheat rather than the commodity wheat, and he had to – get the seed, grow it out, do the milling, do the sales. In Bob's books, talks about how he did that for his 2,000-acre wheat farm that he and his father had, and also involving some of his neighbors. So what happens when you take your farmland out of conventional ag? In order to get these premiums, you have to do a lot of different work. Now, there are farmers in Iowa that are doing it by growing organic corn and also growing food-grade corn for different markets, commodity market. And as a farmer, even though it takes a huge effort to do this and pull yourself out of the conventional system, and you have to get really creative and think this through, and it is not something that you do in one crop cycle. Anyway, you got to think out of the box to do these things. But the good news is if you have – once you have this up and running, you are not at the forces of the market in the same way. And economically, you're in a whole – you're a whole lot more stable. So it's really good work. It really does apply to all kinds of commodity crops. So give a listen to what Bob has to say. Bob Quinn, the Montana wheat farmer, and how he got off of the commodity treadmill. And he just didn't do this yesterday. This is a 20-year process or so. But the good news is, in the end, it is well worth it.
Thanks to Kathleen Dullett and Christine Lang for making this lecture possible to share with you. Kathleen Dullett is with the ISU Agronomy Department as an organic specialist, and Christine Lang is with the Sustainable Agriculture Department.
As a researcher and as a writer, I just wanted to give you a little bit of context from my perspective of why I think Bob's experience and this story is so important in the context of sort of global challenges. So in addition to the things that we know about how transition to organic systems can help us with environmental issues like water quality and soil health, the sort of public health ramifications, transition to organic agriculture is also a really powerful economic development strategy. And for that very reason, it can create some surprising alliances. And so that brings me to my story, which is a little over a decade ago. I was a fresh-faced, brand new congressional staffer, just arrived in Washington, D.C. to change the world. And I went to work for, I'm from Montana, I went to work for Senator John Tester. He'd recently gotten elected organic farmer from Montana, to serve in the U.S. Senate, really on this platform of a green economy. And I was really fired up to get in there and help Senator Tester build a green economy. I'd been there for about a week when I got a question from a constituent about the potential for wind energy. But I had a mentor in the office who, to me, was just had this amazing encyclopedic knowledge of all things agriculture and NEPA. So I went over to Matt's desk and I said, "What do you know about the potential for wind energy in Montana?" And he said, "You need to know about Bob Quinn." And he pulls up this picture on his computer of this guy in a cowboy hat standing in front of a bunch of wind turbines with a big smile on his face. And he said, "This is one of the few people in this country who's really serious about building a 21st century economy and build partnerships around these ways of living that really do create broad-based prosperity in our communities." So it was just a tremendous honor about 10 years later when Bob came up to me at a farm tour that we were both on in Montana and said he was thinking about writing a book about this work and about what he'd seen in decades of trying to build this kind of prosperity through sustainable agriculture and new kinds of energy and just a new economic model that was more about building broad-based prosperity. And I'm really excited for you to have a chance to hear firsthand from Bob Quinn.
Thank you very much, Liz. And this has been a great partner to work with. What she didn't tell you that before we met, I had spent 5 years trying to write my own book. If you read the book, you'll find out that not knowing anything about what I'm doing has never been a deterrent for me. So I got together with Liz, and she did in 5 months what I couldn't do in 5 years. Every time you go to the store and you put an item in your grocery basket, every time you go to a restaurant and you order a meal, or you go home and you prepare a meal or share a meal with your friends or your family, you are committing what Wendell Berry called an agricultural act. Because what you eat influences very much what I plant. So I want you to think of us as a unit, as a partnership. You know, in recent years, we've had giant corporations really come between us. We're not as acquainted as we once were. Well, to give you a little background on my life, I was raised on a wheat and cattle ranch in north central Montana. It was 2,400 acres, which is about the average size for Montana, which is about 2,500 in those days. Started by my grandfather in 1920, and we grew wheat and cattle. That's what we did. And we had a little barley and sometimes a little oats for the cows and and some spring wheat, but mostly winter wheat. And I was raised thinking of wheat really as a staff of life, and I was proud to grow it. I mean, this is the grain which built the great civilizations from antiquity. The Babylonians, the Greeks, the Romans, the Egyptians were all based on a wheat diet, and they performed miracles for their days, right? They became great civilizations. Yet now, today, we have a different situation in this country. In the last 50 years or so, we've reached a point where 20% of the people have wheat sensitivities and don't even eat wheat anymore. As a wheat farmer, I'm not happy about that. I could say other things, but I'm not happy about this. I'm frustrated. I want to know why. What's gone wrong? What is going on with the staff of life? And now I think of the staff of life, it's broken. And why is it broken? I think that after a lot of study, I found that the answer is just not one thing. So the problem with wheat sensitivities, I say, sits on a three-legged stool. One leg, and they're all broke. One leg is production, so what goes on in the farm. The second is processing, what goes on in the mills, the flour mills, and the bakeries. And the third is what goes on in plant breeding. Those are the three things that make up the foundation of the wheat industry, and also the problems with the wheat industry. So, after graduating from high school, I went to Montana State University for 5 years, and I studied botany and plant pathology. I love plants. I was going to be a great plant scientist. That's what my dream was. And I really love science, and I love plants. And so I went from Montana State to the University of California, Davis, and I studied plant biochemistry there for also 5 more years. So after 10 years, I decided that I had really become to see science really co-opted by a regime which pit one scientist against another, fighting for grants and money. And I thought, wow, is this the way it is? And we were told in our lab not to speak to competing laboratories because they were in contention for the same grant that we were in contention for. And I thought, wow, that's not why I came to study science. I came to push back the frontiers of knowledge and all this. And I was a little surprised at that. So I thought, well, I'm not sure I want to get into that deal. And I decided after a couple of years of business for myself in California that I would return home to Montana. And I packed up my whole family. We left Woodland, California in 1978, and we headed north. We came back to our farm, and my folks are still there. My dad wasn't ready to retire yet, but he was thrilled to have me come back and work together. And I found it was a great joy to work with my dad. It was a much different relationship than when you're a teenager. But one thing was different. The farm was still all the same, but the thing now that was different, we had two families living on the income that provided very nicely for one family, but was a little stretched to provide for two. And this wasn't a problem unique to us. As commodity prices would swing up and down, as input costs kept going up, we found ourselves into more and more of a squeeze. And many of my friends went in order not to put the farm into jeopardy, would go to town and get extra jobs. I really didn't want to do that. I came home to farm, and I didn't come home to, you know, go to town and get another job. And so I thought, how can we add value to what we have to bring in some more money for the farm? And I thought of lots of different things. You know, with my scientific training, I thought, well, I could set up a soil testing laboratory. And I ordered all this kits and everything. You know what I found out? Guess when the soil scientists are the most busy? Spring planting time, right? Well, that didn't work. And that was a short-lived project. But then I found a cousin in Southern California, and he lined me up with an idea to go together and start a business selling my wheat, high protein, best wheat for bread making from Montana directly to whole grain bakers in Southern California. And we started Montana Flour and Grains in 1983. And we sold our wheat by the truckload. And we cleaned it and bagged it. And I always heard, you know, that the middleman made all the money. The first 3 months we had a profit, and I thought, wow. Why doesn't everybody do this? And it wasn't without its challenges, however. And one of the challenges I had was less than a year that went by, my customer called me up. His name was Jim. He's from Food for Life was the name of the company, but a pretty successful baker in L.A. area. And he said, say, Bob, he says, you know that great wheat you've been sending me? Can you see if you can find some organic grain just like it, the same quality? And I don't know how many of you guys are in business, but, you know, when your customer calls and asks for something, what do you say?
Yes, sir.
Oh, Jim, don't worry about a thing. I'll have it in less than 2 weeks. Okay, thank you. Bye-bye. I hung up the phone. And I thought to myself, I don't even know any organic farmers. In fact, I don't even believe in this organic stuff. I had been taught all my life and through all my college years that a wheat plant, for example, couldn't tell the difference between a molecule of nitrogen coming out of a manure pile and one coming out of a bag of ammonium sulfate. And that's what I believed. And so when a friend of mine at Davis came up to me in the mid-1970s, organic, you know, in California, was just starting to evolve at that point, and he was telling me all about this. And I thought, this guy's a law student. What does he know about agriculture? I'm the farm kid. So I really dismissed all this organic talk just out of hand. I thought it was a bunch of hooey. I really did. And so yet, when a customer asked for something, I was there to serve my customer. I didn't want to lose a customer. He was a very good customer. He's my first customer. So I went looking for organic grain. And within a few days, I made enough calls. I finally found some in northeast Montana, about 300 miles from us. And I drove up there in my truck. And in those days, it was the affidavit program. So my customers in California, had a two-year requirement to be off chemicals, to be organic. And you had to have a signed affidavit if you didn't have anything else. This is really before we got going in certification in Montana and a lot of other states. And he signed, oh, yes, I'm organic. And I said, okay, thank you very much. Loaded it up and off to California it went, and everybody was happy, right? And so he kept ordering it. And then I started meeting other organic farmers. And then I had the chance to go to an organic farmers group meeting. And that was a very different experience for me than I had ever had going to my Farm Bureau meetings and my Montana grain grower meetings, where the basic topic of conversation was either the low commodity prices that were going down the toilet, or how we're going to get bigger government payments, and what can we do about changing the farm program to get more money into our pockets. And it wasn't all gloom and doom, but there was very little discussion about what was going on the farm. Of course, they're always bragging about feeding the world and all that kind of stuff. But I was more worried about survival on my farm. And when I went to this organic group meeting, the discussion was, wow, the new crops I'm trying, the rotations that are breaking up weed cycles so I don't have to use chemical sprays and herbicides, the how my field feels to my under my feet as I walk across it. I can feel a tilt that I didn't used to feel before. And I was astounded. I said, wow, I never heard people talk like this before, especially not farmers. And my interest was really perked. And I thought, you know, I love research. I love experimentations. I'm going to go home. And the more I talk to these guys, I'm going to go home and try my own experiments. So in 1986, we had our first experiment on our farm. So I had 20 acres of alfalfa that we turned under, and we worked the whole summer. And then right next to that was my chemical field of 20 acres. And I tested for nitrogen, and I fertilized the chemical field to the same level as the alfalfa was, which is about in the about 90 pounds an acre. That's about what we want for our wheat. And it was already there with the alfalfa. And then we put on, I think we were putting on urea at that time, and planted everything the same with winter wheat. The next harvest came, and we cut the two plots, and the yields were almost identical. I think the chemical field out-yielded the organic field by one bushel an acre. One was 38, one was 37. That's decent for us for winter wheat. The protein, which is also very important to us, was also nearly the same. The organic field in this case outdid the conventional field by about 0.2 of a point, about 15.6 to 15.4, something like that. Very good protein. And my father was astounded. I was jubilant. I thought, wow, this really looks promising. And so I said to Dad, I said, let's try some more. And so we had a little farmer son, this conference, you know how it is when you're in a minority stockholder position. They might be like that. And so we had a compromise of sorts. And we ended up with, I forgot, we're between 25 and 30% of the farm we're going to go right into organic conversion. And so the next year was 88. And for us, it was a terrible drought year. And a lot of times in Montana with drought come grasshoppers. And this was no exception. And the grasshoppers are just coming by the hordes. And so with my chemical field, I called up my friendly, spray pilot. I said, hey, George, the grasshoppers are pretty bad. Can you do something about that? And he said, oh, don't worry about a thing. Boom, here comes the plane, malefying over the whole field. And just like that, all the grasshoppers, of course, everything else, is dead. And in fact, he told me, he said, now don't go in this field for at least 24 hours. You know, after all, we're spraying a poison on here, which, you know, sometimes you don't think about you're spraying poisons, but that's what you're doing. And I said, okay, don't worry. And I can do that. Meanwhile, across the creek is my organic field. And the grasshoppers are also coming, you know, through the pasture. The pasture's starting to dry down a little bit. I know they're going to be showing up pretty soon. And so I called out some of my organic friends. I said, what the heck do you do about grasshoppers? And one of my neighbors, 100 miles away or so, said to me, so, well, try Nosema locusta. It's a protozoa. It causes the grasshoppers to get sick and die. And it'll protect your crop. So I got this Nosema locusta, which was a protozoa on wheat bran, and you spread it out just in a narrow band around your perimeter where the grasshoppers are coming from. The grasshoppers find that, and they eat that all up, the bran. They love wheat bran, and they get sick. And then before they die, or maybe while they're dying, all their friends show up and eat them. I don't know where they learned that, but it's very effective. Because they only got into the field, say, 20 or 30 feet, and they ate almost everything down, and then they quit. I didn't know why they quit, but they quit because they're all dead. And when I harvested that field, there were very, very few grasshoppers in the combine tank, and it wasn't a great big pile of wheat either. It was a drought year, but we were glad to get anything. Meanwhile, across the coulee with my chemical field, the grasshoppers that were all dead that I told you about, guess what? All their friends showed up about 10 days later. and they started in munching where the other ones left off. Well, by now, I really couldn't afford justifying another spray plane, because that's not for free, let me tell you. This is not for free, and it's kind of an expensive operation. And I said, well, I'm just going to let it go. And by the time harvest came, we had much less grain in the ground grain tank and quite a bit more grasshoppers. In fact, I think there are more grasshoppers than wheat kernels. And I tell you what, that was the last time I used a chemical on my farm. We had done everything that chemistry had to offer us, and it failed. We had tried the biological control, and it worked spectacularly. And from that day to this, we haven't put a chemical on our farm. And I never looked back, and it's been great fun and a great rewarding experience to me. And I try to preach that all over the state of Montana, and then all over the country wherever I went, and then all over the world wherever I got a chance to go and talk, because I really think that this brought us so many advantages. And so the advantages that we had right away as we started to convert the rest of the farm, and we had everything converted within 2 more years. And by 91, we were 100% certified organic and have been that way ever since. We lowered our all the input costs. We increased the value of our crops, our outputs. We increased the agronomic and economic viability of the whole farm. And for me, it made farming much more fun. Made farming fun again. I loved the farm when I was growing up, most of the things. But to me, it was a great joy to come back and be part of the farm. But it wasn't a great joy to start going backwards economically and to smell those sprays and everything. I shouldn't tell you, but my dad did most of the spraying. I figured, well, he's done having kids, right? And I let him do that. I wouldn't probably do that today. But we're not doing that anymore. That's the good news. But I found it really increased my appreciation for what was going on the farm, and making money was also fun. So after 30 years of research, I continued researching and having experimental plots every year and comparing rotations and comparing all different crops and what we were doing. And these are the things I've learned, that principles of regenerative organic systems are built upon, first, diversity. And so if you look out in nature, in the grasslands, in the prairies, in the forests, in the even the deserts, what do you see? You see any monocultures? You see any spray planes? You see any fertilizer trucks? So how does it work? Decade after decade, millennia after millennia, how does it work? It works because everything is interrelated. And all the plants and the animals and the bacteria, the fungi, everything that's alive in the soil, above the soil, beneath the soil, is all giving or taking from the system in a completely balanced and recyclable nature. And that's how it works. So my view now is that soil regeneration is really the key to this. And the closer that we can mimic nature, the closer we can come to a regenerative, sustainable, organic system. And this is the goal.
You're listening to KHOI. This is the Donalana Kitchen, and you are listening to a lecture by Bob Quinn called Grain by Grain.
So what we have is the principle that healthy soils produce healthy plants, produce really healthy people. And that's what we really want to talk about. And then I've also learned that in regenerative organic agriculture, we feed the soil, and we focus on the soil and not the plants. You remember earlier when I was telling you about a plant not knowing the difference between a molecule of nitrogen where it came from? That may still be true. But we don't focus on the plant. We focus on the soil. And if the soil is healthy, it translates that health to the health of the plant. The plants are better able to withstand insects and diseases and also produce healthier food. So that's been quite an eye-opener to me, and it changed a lot of the way I think about my farm and about how we grow. So we can't really grow everything at once. I haven't figured that out yet. On our farm, we have a 9-year rotation that tries to mimic the diversity we find in nature. And so what you see in red are the soil building years. I don't know how many of you have been to Montana or further west. Yeah, let me tell you this. This may be a shock. We have to water our lawns and our gardens. We only have 12 to 14 inches of rain annually. So we only grow a crop every other year. And the off years, we used to do what they call summer fallow. It means we'd cultivate the ground every three or four weeks so the weeds wouldn't grow. Now they use glyphosate and chem fallow. They spray it two or three times a year so the weeds don't grow. But what we do as an organic farmer, we are planting soil-building crops, mostly legumes, peas, sweet clover, lentils, alfalfa, to build up the soil. And most of those crops were terminating by mid-June, just as the rains are starting to diminish. And then we do not, if we're really lucky, we have enough to mulch to cover the ground. We don't have to cultivate all the rest of the season. If we don't have enough and we start to grow, we do cultivate then through the rest of the season, but we don't have anything growing. And so we're conserving moisture, but yet we've grown a crop that feeds the soil on that soil building year. And then the cash crop years, we were growing winter wheat or spring wheat, barley. We grow hullus and purple barleys. I'm growing mostly ancient and heritage wheats. We grow high oleic safflower, which we crush on the farm and turn into high oleic safflower oil, which is the best kind of oil for high temperature cooking. It's on these little snacks you find back in the back. I don't have time to tell you the story, but you have to buy the book. Okay, and the book tells you the whole story about the snacks and some of these other enterprises we've done on the farm. But I'll tell you a secret. After learning how to sell wheat, first from the truckload, then down to the sack with Southern Italian Middlebar stone ground flour, now we sell it by the ounce. This really helps the economic bottom line of the farm when you're selling your products by the ounce. And they're really tasty. You just you try them and tell me what you think. Anyway, we have this 9-year rotation. We're not married to it. It's our outline. It's our guide. So each field doesn't seem more than the same crop for once every 9 years. But if a big weed problem comes in, this is our big guns here, alfalfa. And if we have a big problem, we put in alfalfa whenever we need to. If there's less of a problem, we put in some of the peas or the lentils or for kind of low input folks and the sweet clovers in between. So that's kind of what we're doing. After experimenting on my farm, I used to say, you know, regenerative agriculture, I really think it has a future. And my dad even agreed with that. He didn't think organic could feed the world. I think they can. And if you have a question about that, we'll talk about that later. But now, recently, in the last 20 years or so, I've had a chance to do experiments in every continent on the earth, so all 5 continents. And I've met organic farmers and seen organic farms all over the world. And now I am convinced, sincerely, that organic, regenerative organic agriculture not only has a future, it is a future. What we're doing right now with chemical agriculture is an artificial system, only successful because of high inputs, which cost a lot of money. And farmers aren't making much money from this system anymore. They're failing. There's a lot of high costs to the cheap food, which is the object of this great productivity drive that we have in this country. But it cannot be sustained. The chemicals that are polluting our earth and all the other things that are causing troubles cannot be sustained. This is not a sustainable system. And the sooner that we start recognizing that and turning into sustainable organic regenerative systems, the better off we will all be. That's my belief. Another thing that happened quite unexpectedly to me when I went to started going to food shows. And this is my wife and I are early 90s, and we're in a food show in California. A lady came up to me just right out of the blue, shook my hand just like this real firm, looked right in my eyes, and she said to me, "Thank you for growing food for my family." And I thought, wow, no one ever thanked me for growing food for the family ever. When you're a commodity grower, you take your load of wheat to the elevator, you dump it in a big pit, the elevator manager comes out, takes samples, and tries to figure out how we can pay you less for that grain by finding something wrong, right? It's too light, there's too many whatever, stones or something else. No one ever says thank you. In fact, as a grain farmer, you know, as wheat farmers, we don't go to farmers markets. I know you didn't realize that. But we never see an end customer. We don't even think about it much because we're, after all, we're raising commodities. We're not raising food. We're raising commodities. And we think about it that way because we're used to speaking of it that way and hearing of it spoken that way. And when this lady thanked me for growing food for her family, I was astounded. And I went home, and I tell you truly, I never looked at my farm the same again, ever. From that day to this, I haven't grown one commodity on my farm. None. I only grow food. Good food for people's enjoyment, for people's health, and to bring folks together. And that's what I do. And it had really an effect on me that I can't describe and changing the way I looked at my farm. So anyway, that was one big incident. Another big incident that I didn't expect was my interest always in trying new things. And again, I haven't got time to tell you the whole story, but we ended up with this ancient grain. I saw it when I was a kid, the county fair. Old man was passing this. He's probably younger than I am now, but anyway, looked pretty old to me. And he had an old red Folgers coffee can, and he said, "Hey, Sonny," he said, "come on over here." He said, "Would you like some of King Tut's wheat?" I said, "Oh, well, yeah, that sounds pretty interesting." And so I went over, and he poured this handful in my hand, and it was giant wheat. And it was, the legend was, you'll have to read all about the book. It had come from a tomb in Egypt, right? Doesn't get much better than that. And it was years before I went to Egypt and found out to myself that that was all fabricated. But anyway, for 10 years or so, we believed that it came from Egypt. And now I wear my hat. You see, I take it with me everywhere I go. Well, you know, you never know when there might be a complete crop failure. And so I've got the seed source to start all over right handy. And anyway, we thought this would be a great novelty. And my folks went with me to our very first food show in 1986 in Anaheim, California. And by this time, we started a stone ground flour business. We added that to our high-protein wheat. We had a picture of our mill, or an example of our mill right in the booth. And at the end of the show, after 1,000 people walked by our booth, my cousin and I had our pockets just full of business cards and referrals. We thought, oh, man, this is the best thing since sliced bread. And my dad had brought this little jar of this old King Tut's wheat, and he just showed everybody. And after 3 days, guess what? He had one card and one person who said, oh, yeah, that's, oh, man, I'm looking for that. You grow that, and I'll buy everything you can produce. And he went home so excited. We had 50 pounds in the garage or in the shed, and we planted that. And so my idea was, here was my vision of this. I thought, wow, here is a novelty that we could probably get up to 15, 20 acres of this stuff, sell it by the pound. See, I wasn't down to the ounce yet. Sell it by the pound, and it would be the most valuable crop in the whole farm, you know, acre by acre. And here's what happened. After the first year, in 86, we, on one farm, that was ours, we planted one half acre. We had zero products on the market. We had one person interested. But after 30 years, we had 250 organic farms that we were contracting with in Montana, Alberta, and Saskatchewan, 100,000 acres, and over 3,500 products on the market. Most of them were in Italy. About 90% of the products were in Italy. They were taking 75% of the grain, but they were really doing magical things with it. And that was really way past my expectations. So it just goes to show you, you know, don't ever give up a good idea because you don't know where it might take you. And even if you might not think it's such a good idea, it can still go places, as this one really did. We knew that we had done some taste tests with it. It had a great taste and a great flavor. You can try some of the goodies in the back are made with Kamut Fresh here in Iowa, and you can get a sample of this. You can get an idea of the flavors. What we didn't expect was another thing that was completely weren't even thinking about this. A lady who was a good friend of my family lived in nearby Haver. She had terrific problems eating wheat. And my dad gave her some of this pasta that we had made out of the Kamut. It's a very close relative of the derm. It's a tetraploid. It's in that group of family with the derms and emmer, and it makes great pasta. And so we were handing this pasta out. I would have never given this lady some pasta because I knew she couldn't touch wheat with a 10-foot pole. She was so, and she was sick with other other foods and environmental problems. She couldn't even go into a new house because the formaldehyde in the carpet, new carpets, was enough to completely debilitate her. Her muscles would just give out and she'd collapse. So she was on the edge of it. And yet she would do this muscle testing, hold the product closer to her body, and she had a sensitivity to know if it was really going to make her sick or not. And she felt, well, maybe I could try this. And so she did. And the next day she called out my dad and she said, "What is this stuff?" She said, "Not only can I eat it," which was a little bit of a surprise, but she said, "After I ate it, I felt better." I said, "Oh, well, we'll give you some more." So we gave her some more. And she continued to eat it and was fine with it. And then she says, "You know, I have a sister that also cannot eat wheat. And do you mind if we send a little bit to her?" And said, "Oh, no, no problem. We'll send her a whole box." And so after she had eaten it for several weeks, not only could she eat it, but she was not only feeling better, but she was less sensitive to other foods that she was having problems with. And when I heard that, now in the mouth of two witnesses we have, I thought, whoa, this is something very special. This is just not a novelty out of some old tomb somewhere. This is something that could help people.
Listen to KHOI. This is the Donalana Kitchen, and you are listening to a lecture by Bob Quinn.
And so I really started wondering what in the world was going on with this stuff. And I thought, we need to treat this real special and protect it. And so I thought, well, one of the ways we can do this, and this is mostly my dad who was driving this program, we instituted a trademark. And so Kamut, I thought to myself, I wonder what the ancient Egyptians called wheat. That would be kind of a fun thing to know. And I looked up an ancient Egyptian hieroglyphic dictionary, and it said wheat, and it had Kamut, and it had the letters all spelled out in hieroglyphics. And since this is coming from a dead language, we are able to trademark the name Kamut, and that's what we did. And Khorasan is the common name for the wheat, and so we always have to have a trademark modifying something, so we had to have Khorasan in there. And then a trademark is not... You know, it's not an ownership. It's not like a patent. You know, I study Monsanto a lot, and I try to do everything the opposite that they do. And that's worked pretty well for me. And so rather than patent it, we trademarked it. We use a trademark to market it. That means that anybody, I believe that grains and things that we find in the earth are really a gift from the Lord for all of us. And they shouldn't be patented or controlled. They should be free for everybody to enjoy and to benefit from. And so anybody who wants to can grow Khorasan wheat and call it whatever they want and do with it whatever they want. But if they want to call it Kamut or use the Kamut trademark, then they need to be part of our program. And our program guarantees the customer that the grain is always organically grown. It's 100% ancient Khorasan wheat. It's not been mixed with anything, any cheap stuff. It's high in protein and minerals, and the claims that we make about it are supported by research and by science. And so we started into research programs. I had a hard time finding anybody in America 30 years ago who wanted to help me with research programs. And everybody I called, they'd say to me, "Oh, yes," he said, "well, let me tell you what I think about that, Bob." They'd say, you're kind of condescending, you know, there's a dirt farmer from Montana calling the biggest institutions in the country. And he said, "We'll tell you how it is." I said, "Wheat is wheat. All wheat has gluten. Your wheat's no different than anybody else's wheat. And if people think they can feel better eating it, it's all in their head." And I said, "Oh, well, okay." And that was the end of that conversation. But when I went to Italy, I found a completely different attitude. Any Italians here? Anybody been to Italy? Okay, a few have been there. Okay, good. Okay, you know how it is in Italy, okay? If an Italian cannot eat pasta, This is more than an inconvenience, you see. This is a cultural crisis. And they don't run down to the corner store and order wheat-free, gluten-free. They say, what's the deal? You know, what can I do? And they want to know what's wrong and how to fix it. And so the researchers there had a different attitude. And they saw some of the same things that we were seeing in America. Not as much, but there was some there that people were starting to have trouble with wheat. Of course, they're importing a lot from America, so maybe that's where the trouble is coming from. But I found a willing crew of scientists in University of Bologna and University of Florence in the medical, the research hospital portion of Florence. And they were very interested in this this problem. So after about the last 15 years, we have now 31 peer-reviewed journal articles published in really top journals, not just the self-publication stuff or reports. These are really good science that's been verified. We have 15 more articles on the way of a myriad of subjects. And once we found that the grain was producing anti-inflammatory effects, we know that inflammation is closely tied to all chronic disease. And so then we started studying chronic disease. And we studied irritable bowel syndrome, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, non-alcoholic fatty liver syndrome, and now we just finished studies on fibromyalgia. And we see all the same things with every study. It's very, very consistent. These are double-blind crossover studies. People eat one diet or the other diet, unknown to them what they are. Then they have a washout period for 6 or 8 weeks, then do 6 or 8 weeks of the other diet. So they have internal controls. And even some of the tests the professors didn't know, the research scientists didn't know who was eating what, so it's double-blinded that way. We found in every case that anti-inflammatory properties of ancient wheat exceeded modern wheat by 30 to 45%. Modern wheat causes inflammation in low levels, and this ancient wheat was anti-inflammatory. They increased the antioxidant capacity, cholesterol, blood sugar, insulin resistance went down, which led us to our diabetes studies, and they were even more dramatic in those studies. We saw in every case that blood, magnesium, zinc, and calcium went up. And so you think, what's going on? What have we done to change wheat so much? So we have traded all the advantages of health and nutrition that we're seeing in these tests for high yields and efficiency of production. And let me show you how that works. So here's the what we've done in our breeding programs. And this is not to point fingers or be critical, because all this is done in the idea of making food cheaper for people. That's a good thing, right? And making it more abundant so no one starves. This is also a good thing. But there turns out to be a very high cost. But this is the way they did it for the farmers. They made the plant first and made it shorter. And they introduced dwarfing genes so that now we have mostly semi-dwarf wheat in the country, and it produces more than the giant tall wheats in most years, except drought years it's not as good. But they've also introduced plant resistance to plant diseases and even insects, and then the ability to respond better to high inputs of nitrogen fertilizer, so we can have these terrific inputs and then get out more output. And that's the program for the farmers. Now, in the bakery, we got the opposite thing going on. They want more bread for less wheat, okay? So all these different breads are made with the same amount of wheat. But do you see the difference? Okay, imagine you're a baker. Look at this one. How would you like to sell air for the price of bread, okay? That's what's happening here. Okay, this is a great thing, right? And this is done by changing the gluten, so the gluten now is more elastic and can hold more air. The gluten here is popping, and the bubbles don't get so big, so the bread is not as raising as much. Here, this is full of big air pockets inside, and it's full because the gluten hasn't popped, and it can retain that air. That's also great news, right? Except for unintended consequences. So we have unintended consequences in three big areas. We have this more complex gluten I already mentioned to you. Turns out that a lot of people have trouble digesting this more complex gluten. It's not the same. It's a little bit more difficult to digest. At the same time, the bakers have decided or discovered if they use fast-rising yeast in their bakery, they can raise that bread so fast that it only has time to digest the sugar that they added to the dough to make the gas, the carbon dioxide, to raise the bread, pop into the oven, and then they get ready for the next batch. So it's just constantly turning over very, very fast. Fast speed equals low cost equals high profits, right? This is great news. So, but what's happening when you compare this type of fast rising yeast to slow fermentations or long fermentations, which was traditionally done, and then especially sourdough, the longer you ferment bread, the more you're breaking down proteins, starch complexes, and you're really pre-digesting the flour before you eat it. Therefore, people who have problems with digestion have half the work done for them if they're eating long fermentation of sourdough, for example. In fact, sourdough that's, and this is extremely long fermentation, but at 48 hours, will destroy 97% of all the gluten in the flour. This is enough to really solve the problem for some people. And then if they leverage that even more by starting with heritage or ancient grains where the gluten hasn't been changed in the first place, then they really are mostly out of the woods and can enjoy it. The other thing that's going on is glyphosate. For those who don't know about glyphosate, it's the wonder child in Roundup. Although some of the luster is off the label now with recent lawsuits that are going the other way for Monsanto and their friends. And also we're finding it's used in such high rates now that we have resistant weeds, for example, but we also have traces of glyphosate in our food. We have traces in the rainwater that falls on our farm. This is a really serious situation to be in. And glyphosate, as most of you probably know, and according to the reports from Monsanto, who never lies, right? Never lies. They say that it has no effect on human cells. And there hasn't been really too much direct effect been proven, but because the effect is the metabolic pathways that are found only in plants. But guess where else they are found? In bacteria. And guess where bacteria live? First of all, in the soil. So if you soak your soils with glyphosate, you're killing off your bacteria. But guess where else? We have more bacteria right here than all the cells in our human body, human cells in our body. There's more bacteria cells living here. And if you start to mess with these guys, these are your helpers. I mean, they digest your food and they put up some products that really keep you healthy. And now if you start disrupting all that, you're not going to be as healthy. And many people are experiencing that. And many times the research coming out of Canada suggests that the symptoms that people are finding with what they call wheat sensitivities are really the same symptoms coming from glyphosate contamination. So it's hard to know how much of the wheat sensitivity is really related to that, but certainly more than just a little. So how are we going to change the future? In summary, I've got two suggestions. First of all, you remember my three-legged stool idea? We could change every leg of that stool. First of all, in production, we can shift from high input chemical agriculture to regenerative organic agriculture, making healthier soils and healthier plants. In processing, rather than trying to focus on high efficiencies and speed, we can try to focus on preserving or enhancing nutritional value, like with sourdough, with bread. With seeds, rather than just selecting all the time for higher and higher yields, we can select for higher and higher nutrition and make what we are breeding in the plant breeding systems healthier. The other thing that we can do is we can address the high cost of cheap food. You know, farmers are the first ones to pay for the high cost of cheap food because they don't get anything, they hardly get enough to make a living for what they produce. So when you're buying cheap bread and flour, you can thank the farmer who grew it and received so little money for it that he can't even hardly make a living anymore. It would not be a big deal at the cost of the final loaf of bread to be paying the farmers a fair price at the farm gate. And this is being done with organic systems. And communities also pay a high price because when the farmers go broke and can no longer support those small towns, the small towns start to decline. And businesses shut down because they're not being supported anymore. It's a vicious cycle. And we could reverse that cycle, revitalize Main Street, and create more jobs. With the planet, think about what would happen if we could reduce pollution of our planet and reduce the cost of cleaning up that pollution. That would be a big savings to us. And we can even mediate climate change with the sequestration of carbon that would come with organic systems. This is an additional advantage that we don't have time. I don't have time to talk to you about much today. But the biggest savings, the biggest reduction in the high cost of cheap food could be in the reduction of chronic disease. You know, we have a higher and higher percentage of our population that is sick with chronic disease, and no nation can afford to have a significant amount of its people sick. And that's where we're headed toward. So, in conclusion, there's a couple things I want you to remember. First, you and I, we're all in this together. We're not just farmers in this corner and consumers in this corner. We're producers and co-producers. We're in this together. And it makes a difference how we work together. So a real change, we need to get to know each other, get to know our challenges and our goals, help each other accomplish those. The farmer's goal is, of course, to make a decent living and to care for their soil so it doesn't just last this generation, but for generations, eons in the future. And, of course, the goals of the eaters are to have nutritious food that promotes their health, not just keeps them full. What can we do? Every time we go to the store, and encourage your friends to do the same thing, you leverage your efforts that way, put one more item of organic products into your food basket. And so wherever you are in buying organic, if it's even 2% or 90%, just put one more in every time you go, and it'll start to make a difference. Get acquainted with some farmers, and if you're farmers yourself and you're not organic, just do a little experiment. Try some. If you're organic, just keep on going. And those that you're not farmers, give those organic farmers a little encouragement so that we can work together to create a food system where everybody wins. We win around the table in our health, our families. We win in our small communities by revitalizing them. We win in our planet by making a healthier planet. And we win in our longevity and our health. And that's why I wrote the book. And that's why I'm hoping to share with you guys. And I'm here to answer questions. And thank you very much for your attention.
This is the Donalana Kitchen. That was Bob Quinn, Montana wheat farmer, talking about his adventures in large-scale organic farming. Find out more in his new book, Grain by Grain, written with Liz Carlisle. Thanks to the ISU SUSAG Department and the Agronomy Department for making this lecture available to the Donalana Kitchen and KHOI Community Radio. Been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We get together here once a week. We're here live at noon, Tuesdays.
Encouraging you to cook. We always do.
Hey, and if you miss this program, well, this doesn't make sense because if you miss it, you don't know this, but we're also, we also are repeated. The same program, you'd be able to hear it at 7 p.m. this evening on this fine radio station. You can find out more about KHOIF at KHOIFM.org. Cook, cook, do that. Get in the kitchen, feed yourself. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had fine engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and do enjoy life.